Welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast that explores the creative and curious world of work through monologues and conversations with artists, creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, and changemakers. There are three questions at the core of this episode with capacity architect Scott Ritzheimer. One, what type of leader are you? Two, how are you bringing people together? And three, what stage is your business at in the life cycle of an organization? In this conversation, Scott shares the four types of leaders in every organization, what predictable success is and where it fits into a company's life cycle, how companies lose their way, and why systematizing decision-making is the secret to scaling a business. Grab something to take notes with because there is a lot to learn in this episode. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/579.
And I love learning and exploring how to get people to work together. It's something that we've been trying to do for a very long time. And for whatever reason, it still eludes many of us much of the time, including myself. But I can nerd out on that all day, every day.
Where does your interest in getting people to work better together stem from?
From trying to do it. I love business. I didn't realize it. I went all kinds of different paths, as a kid and growing up, never thought I'd land in business. And now that I look back, it's kind of always been there and I don't know how I missed it, but I love it. I love bringing people together to accomplish something, which is fundamentally what business is about, mm-hmm. at least to me. Yeah. And so being in that space, you don't get real far doing it by yourself. It doesn't matter if you're a solopreneur or you're leading a billion-dollar organization, you got to get people to work together.
Yeah. Wow. You know, we're going to have a good time talking about that because it is challenging to not only understand how other people work, but how you work as well. Yeah. And leadership is definitely one of those topics that is very much probably the most important topic to really talk about when it comes to how you motivate people.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. And, working definition for me of leadership is getting any group of two or more moving in the same direction, basically getting any group of two or more people to achieve their shared goals. And so one of the big travesties, I would say, of most definitions of leadership is that they are somehow, despite the flowery language that they put around it, they're really about whoever's at the top of some kind of org chart. And I think we do ourselves a significant disservice by overvaluing the position side of leadership. Something we could get into, the different types of personalities that we tend to think of as leaders, mm-hmm. when in fact, all of us have a leadership gifting. It just looks very different for at least half of us.
What do you mean by that, for at least half of us?
For at least half of us. So in my work, there's a model that we use. It's called the Synergist model. And it's like a lot of them. There's Myers-Briggs, there's Enneagram, there's all of those. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of nuances that make ours a little unique, particularly with regard to the when question, because mm-hmm. a lot of them talk about the who question, but when is a whole nother ballgame. Maybe we can get to that in a bit. But the thing that I like about it is the simplicity of it. There are four styles. Now, most of us are a combination of two or three of those styles. Some of us are very strongly expressed in one of those styles. But they are all leadership styles. They're not mm-hmm. personality styles, although there's some intersections there. They're not, your spirit animal or something like that. It's just when we get together and we work, how do we lead a group of people together? And two of those styles tend to fit the natural definition of a leader. You'll have these visionary types who are visionaries. Like they don't need much introduction. We get that. It's the people who are from the front. They're often very charismatic. They take big risks. They are, fill in the blank. And so particularly in the business world, those are the leaders. And, you're looking for people with leadership gifting. What you're looking for is visionaries because of what I would argue is a skewed version of leadership. Now, in the nonprofit world, do a lot of work with nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And it's true for anything from a ferret rescue to your local church, whatever it may be. what they all tend to bias toward is what we call synergists, folks that love to bring people together, to rally them together, to kind of, they'll draw on some visionary traits, like having a shared vision, but they're not as interested in the vision as much as they are bringing people together and getting them all to work together. And so even the way I opened this, I'm not actually naturally a synergist, but it was a very synergist saying, you know, I want to, you know, how do we get people to work together?
Right.
That's what they do. And so we see that as leadership because they're bringing people together. They're rallying. Some of your favorite people, just, you know, because of their personality, may be synergists because it's just the way that they're wired. They make you feel better about you. They've got a gift for it. So. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say half of us, because, you know, we've got our group of visionaries that, you know, visionaries are visionaries. And we've got our group of synergists who love to lead people and bring them together. And then we have these other, you know, two styles. And those two styles tend to be the ones who are getting a lot of stuff done. You have operators who will walk through walls to make stuff happen, right? It's like, just point, it's like, tell me what to do and then don't watch. You know, it may not be pretty. It may not be precise, but it will get done. And you know, especially in the business world, I mean, there's phenomenal folks to have around on a team, especially in early days. I work with a lot of startups, and having a handful of operators at your side is just about the best thing that you could do for any entrepreneur. And then the other style is processors. And processors are folks that many that I work with in leadership circles just don't even recognize are leaders at all, you know, because where we expect leaders to be kind of bold and risk-taking and self-starters, processors are risk-averse. They are detail-oriented. They're methodical, some would say slow, you know? And so those operators and processors, they don't necessarily come across with just the like natural, raw leadership as we tend to define it. But try and get something done without an operator. You know, like try and get a whole organization of people moving in the same direction without someone who's actually thinking of the machine that does that, right? Without organizing all of those parts together. And you know, good luck getting a lot done. And so, again, I think what we do is we take this half of the equation, you know, your people, and your vision people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we create a wall where there shouldn't be one between them and the operator and processor styles.
So interesting. What I love about that too, Scott, is that as you're explaining these different types of leadership, there's inevitably that conflict that arises when someone thinks that they're one type of leadership, when in reality, they're a different type. And I imagine that creates some conflict and slows things down as well.
Well, and look at why that happens, right? So it can happen for all kinds of different reasons. But if you're in an organization who values visionary or synergistic leaders, and you want to rise up through the ranks as an operator, right? What do you do? You know, you start to look like that. You look at how they behave. You look at how they talk. You start to emulate that. And that's, you know, it's not actually doing anyone a service. And so, it's one of those things that one of the most powerful things when I'm working with an organization, one of the most powerful things that I can do is shape their definition of leadership. Mm-hmm. And virtually none of them have one, right? Mm-hmm. But they all have one.
Oh, interesting.
Every single one of them has a definition of leadership. Mm-hmm. And because they've never actually sat down to spell it out, it's wrong 100% of the time. Now, even once you go to spell it out, right, what it will typically do is mirror the founder or the top team, right? It'll be a reflection of who they are and how they're wired. But what it isn't is this balanced, you know, four-style approach that really is necessary and essential over time.
Mm. Wow. Like, my mind is blown just thinking about that and the ramifications of that, but also thinking about this idea of, can a person change their leadership style?
Oh, it's a great question. So there's all kinds of different opinions on this, and I'll say there are folks who are way better suited to answer that question scientifically. So none of this is scientific. This is all just, hey, this is what I have learned and what I have seen of doing with this with thousands of people at this point. But what we do to kind of work around the nature versus nurture kind of debate, if you will, is what we've tend to find is that there is a combination of both. And I think most systems that are worth their salt will kind of embrace that to some extent. But the way that I would say it is what tends to happen is we tend to be born and wired as a visionary, an operator, or a processor. I would say if you take someone, you know, 8 to 18 years old, vast majority of them, 90%+ will make that number up, but near as makes no difference. Is going to be some combination of visionary, operator, and processor. And what you tend to find is that the synergist style is one that most of us, not all of us, but most of us will learn. And it's usually the result of really painful discoveries that my style doesn't equal all success, right? It's just banging against the wall of our own style that gets us to recognize, hey, there must be other people wired in different ways, and I must be able to learn from them. And that's what synergists do exceptionally well. And so for us, you know, what I would kind of posit is, most of us are kind of largely locked into the raw wiring of our visionary operator and processorness, again, or whatever combination. But what does change is our ability to leverage that synergist style. That's something that we can learn. People call it EQ. Folks will call it leadership. There's all kinds of names for it. But what it is, it's about kind of taking the step up to the balcony, watching a team engage and seeing it from the top down, right? You can see there's the I don't know if it's a fable or a parable or what, but you know, several blind men get together and they all place their hands somewhere on an elephant, one on its leg, one on its trunk, one on its ear, whatever. And they're all describing something, and for each of them, it's something completely different, but they're all touching the same, a different part of the same animal. I totally butchered that story. Someone else can tell it better, but you get the point.
Exactly.
You get the point. And so that's what synergists do, is they recognize, hey, I've got this visionary who's saying one thing. I've got this processor who's saying another. They're using entirely different language, and they appear to be pointing in perpendicular directions, but they're actually talking about the same thing.
Wow.
And so the leadership of being able to translate that, of being able to bridge the gaps, the natural gaps between the styles, is something that we certainly can learn.
Fascinating. And is that how you get founders and entrepreneurs and teams to really start to recognize predictable success? Because without synergists, things that we would label as predictable probably aren't going to happen.
You've opened up a whole can of worms and you didn't even know you did it. So, here's where it gets really exciting. And this is my favorite part about this model. I mentioned it before. This is the when part of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens in organizational dynamics, for-profit, nonprofit, business unit, family, any organization, any group of two or more, will walk through 7 different stages over the course of their history. So these are predictable stages. They happen in sequence. You move from one to the next, any group of two or more. We could explain a ton of that and why, but let's assume that that's true for a moment. So what happens is we move through these stages in a predictable way. We always go one stage at a time. And the question becomes why? Because we have organizations and they are man-made, right? Mm-hmm. Like they are literally people coming together and making something. How is it that something that we create so consistently follows a pattern of these 7 stages? Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that those 7 stages are a direct reflection of the leadership that happens at each of those stages. Mm-hmm. And so when you overlay these two ideas, you have these seven different stages. I'll rattle them off real quickly just so that folks have a basic idea of what we're talking about. Very easy to understand. We used very technical terms, though, like early struggle, right? Early struggle is that time when you're trying to get whatever it is off the ground. The rocket is on the launch pad, and you know the rockets are firing, and it just sits there shaking. You know, it's not actually moving. It's just shaking. There's smoke and fire and noise, and it's still there. And that's what early struggle is. It's just this kind of fight for survival. It's this fight to get it up off the ground. It does. We're in fun. And that's when things are fun, right? Again, it can be a business. You're selling things like crazy. It could be a nonprofit. You know, you're saving more ferrets than ever before if you're a ferret rescue. Whatever it is, whatever you do, you're doing a lot of it. And so it's, you know, stage two is fun. And it just because it is fun. And then stage three hits and it is no longer fun. It is whitewater. And this whitewater it's this problem that I like to call it the problem of second stage growth. Mm-hmm. And our rocket analogy or metaphor really works here very well because, you know, we got it up off the launch pad, we're hurtling through the atmosphere, and then there's this stage in a rocket's progression that's called max Q. And max Q is a point where the force of gravity and atmospheric pressure and just all of the different things that are trying to keep the rocket on the ground actually reach their peak. It's fascinating. It's, you know, right before it breaks free from the atmosphere's grip. And so the most trying point on a rocket's launch is this max Q phase. Hmm. And so if you know, they do the public launches now. If you listen, they'll talk about max Q. It's really neat.
But interesting.
Once they pass through max Q, they break free and they're into, you know, the place where we can orbit, you know, where we're far enough away from the Earth that, you know, you can reach a sustainable orbit or you can continue off into outer space, wherever you're trying to go. And so it's this stage right before you break free from gravity. You know, it's this stage right before you hit the peak range of your ability to accelerate, to move quickly. There's this stage and in the organizational world, business world, however you want to say that, it is whitewater. And so organizations have to wrestle with this seemingly kind of upside down stage that's happening to a successful organization. It's wild, but it's a stage that happens nonetheless and is one stage away from the peak time, which we call predictable success. You alluded to, or you mentioned this earlier. And predictable success is where you can not only grow like you did back in fun organizations can grow very, very quickly, but they're relatively small, relatively simple. When you get to predictable success, you can scale. And that's the principal difference. Now, from there, we start the decline stages of the model, which is the treadmill, the big rut, and the death rattle. And those largely speak for themselves. We don't have to spend a whole lot of time there, but I'll come back to them in a moment. So just that you know that they're there. So it's early struggle, fun, whitewater, predictable success, treadmill, big rut, and death rattle in that sequence. And we always move through that. So tying these two ideas together. We have our visionaries, typically the one who's out there. It's 2 a.m. and they're tapping away at a keyboard. They're writing on a yellow pad. They're going nuts in their current role. Like they're doing well at it, but they just know that there's a better way. They're haunted by the question, can this, you know, isn't there another way? Mm-hmm. And that's when this vision is born. That's where this organization is born. And so what you'll find in successful startups, they are at the genesis of that startup, not necessarily exclusively, but inclusively. Someone who's there is a visionary. And for all intents and purposes, you really cannot get through early struggle without a strong visionary. But a visionary by themselves, you know, we like to have a little fun with them. They tend to have a high squirrel factor, right? I don't know if you've ever seen Up, you know, the Pixar movie. And Doug is the dog and he just wants desperately to be part of what everybody is doing. But for the life of him, when he sees a squirrel, he's up a tree, you know, he's gone. And our visionaries are like that. They have shiny object syndrome. And so what you'll see in the wake of any brilliant visionary is just a whole host of things that they have started and not finished. And so what you find in successful startups is that that visionary will intuitively recognize, I need help, and they'll go out and they'll find themselves an operator. And it's actually the visionary operator combination that gets organizations off the ground. It's fascinating,
yeah.
Right? It's the visionary says, hey, this is where we're going. And the operator saying, okay, I've got you. You know, we'll get there. And it's that combination of just those two that really is ideal for that getting out of early struggle, getting into fun. And so if you were to look at an org chart from a style standpoint, you have the V at the beginning, you have a VO that gets you out of early struggle, and then you have VOOOOOOOOOOOO. That's what a fun organization looks like, right? It's a visionary quarterbacking a bunch of go-getter done operators. And that's what makes it so fun, right? Yeah. Because it's crazy, right? It's exhausting. But it's fun because you're actually winning. The organization's actually growing. It's not early struggle anymore. And so when I'm working with organizations that are in this fun stage, what I see a lot of organizations who have stalled, right? Mm-hmm. Had some early success, but they've stalled at maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 15 or 20 people. We'll get back to, okay, how are we doing on our visionary operator combination, right? Mm-hmm. Do we have enough operators to get this thing moving? And 9 times out of 10, they don't. 9 times out of 10, they've got too many visionaries running around with great ideas. So they have too many chefs in the kitchen, you know, or they're in an industry that has lots of processors like accounting or, you know, whatever it may be. Or they're in an industry that has lots of synergists like healthcare or, industries like that. And they don't have enough operators. They don't have enough folks who are just like, let's get it done. And so, again, what we can tell from combining these two ideas, this idea of life cycle stages that organizations go through and this idea of leadership styles that we all bring, we can apply the ideal leadership styles for the stage that we're in. And in fun, that's VO.
Yeah.
Now, we want to get to predictable success. That's ultimately where we're going. If we want to scale an organization, not everybody has to, but those who want to, what they'll find out is as you get a bunch of operators, you know, in a company, it starts to become herding cats. You know, it's like we got people running every which direction, and that works really, really well for a long time. It's kind of, have you ever seen 6-year-olds play soccer?
Oh, it's hilarious.
That's it. Like, that's exactly how we do it. And it's a mess. It's a delight to watch.
Right.
But it's very messy. It's just, you know, a herd of 12 kids, which includes both goalies. And, you know, when it hasn't rained in a while, there's a dust cloud over top of them. And then the ball squirts out and everyone runs over there. And that's how we run organizations in fun. And it seems infantile. It seems juvenile, but it's actually right. It's actually one of the most ideal ways, if not the ideal way, to run an organization in those early days. But once you get like 15 people on each side of the ball or 25 people on each side, like you can't move anymore. And so organizations that succeed, you'll find they do this. They do the flock ball thing until it doesn't work anymore. And that's when you're left with a question. You know, is that central to who we are? Like, do we have a value of playing flock ball? Sounds silly, but when you look at the values of small organizations, many of them do. Or do we have a vision for an organization that can be, you know, exponentially greater than it is today? Define that however you'd like, but that's the question, right?
Yeah.
And if we decide, hey, we want to build an organization that can scale, number one way of doing that is to build systems and processes. To build systems and processes, not just like standard operating practices, kind of e-myth thing. That's all wonderful, right? But they should have figured that out by now. What we're really talking about here is systematizing the decision-making process.
Oh, interesting.
It's a whole different ballgame, right? Yeah. And that requires taking the organization from an execution machine, right? Which is largely what it's doing, it's flock ball, to a decision-making machine. Mm-hmm. When you look at organizations that scale, they've mastered the art of decision-making up and down their ranks. And to do that, you can't do that Wild West running and gunning, right? Because those decisions are just all over the map. And so we have to start to systematize that. We have to start to process it. And if we have a visionary who's got the high squirrel factor, right? They're off chasing another squirrel. We've got an operator who's saying, hey, tell me what to do and then don't watch, right? Because it's not going to be pretty. You know, how well are they going to do at creating systems and processes that restrict their ability to make the decisions? Not great, right?
Not great,
you know,
no.
It's not that they don't have any systems or process, like I mentioned before. You know, what they have tends to be as much as they need to stay out of jail, right? That's about the bar.
Right.
And so what tends to happen is they'll take a crack at it. Like, okay, I get we're screwing up in this area. Let's add some systems and processes. But their wiring just prohibits them from making, you know, long-term gains in that way. What they need is someone who thinks in terms of system and process.
Right. And those are the processors.
This is the processor. But again, these processors look completely different, like completely different animals, right? They're not self-starters. They're not, you know, running and gunning. And so you really, for the first time, this is whitewater that we're bumping into. You, for the first time, start to see these leadership clashes, because you have this visionary who's risk-seeking and going after big things and brand new things. And you have this processor who's coming in and trying to restrict and control and to, you know, to create that predictability. And a rift starts to appear. But it's that very difference of vantage points, that very difference in wiring that drives you crazy, that's actually the very thing you need to scale an organization.
Oh, interesting.
And so we bring those three styles together. We've got the visionary, we've got the operator, we've got the processors, all kinds of things that can make those, you know, there's all kinds of dysfunction that can go there. And if we want to have some fun with it, we can. But to come to your question, you're talking about developing your synergistic gifting to get into predictable success. You are exactly right. A VOP team will get you out of whitewater. But left to its own devices, those three worldviews are just so different from each other that they will devolve into chaos. Again, highly predictable form of chaos, right? There's a pattern that they all follow. But what it takes to glue all of that together, what you see top performing teams do as they get into and secure their place in that predictable success stage is that they start to develop that synergist style.
That's so fascinating. What's so interesting too is, like, as you're describing, like, I'm thinking about Disney, like after Walt Disney dies and they bring in, you know, different CEOs, different people to run the business. And I can just see the different types of leadership.
Yeah.
You go from the visionary to the operational CEO to the processor CEO, and there's no synergy. And then you get weird movies like The Aristocats. And,
yes.
You know, and you get all sorts of weird things. And then they find that synergy into, you know, the 90s, into, you know, where they're at today.
Yeah. So fascinating to keep going on the life cycle, because you just described what happens.
Yeah.
So we're in predictable success. We've got a VOPS team, and then the visionary, they move on for whatever reason. They can sell, they can pass away, they can hold on, but just kind of remove themselves from the organization. They can change their style inside the organization. And what they will typically do is bring in the right-hand man, right. Woman, doesn't matter, but the right-hand person.
Right.
And who is that person? They're an operator, right? I mean, you just described it. It's exactly what happened with Bill Gates. And I've just totally lost the name.
Paul Allen?
No, the guy who likes to yell.
Oh, Ballmer.
Yes, Steve Ballmer. Ballmer's an operator, a classic operator, right? And what happens for an organization that goes into treadmill, and the reason that these great institutions lose their way, is that they actually stop leaning into that visionary style. Because it's risky, it's messy, right? It breaks things, and oftentimes unnecessarily.
Right.
And so what they do is they start leaning into the more predictable styles. And so next in line is an operator. Well, it's the very thing that drives an organization into treadmill, is that lack of visionary risk taking. And so what we start to see in these bigger organizations is that the the operator to a lesser extent, you know, that is usually short-lived, mm-hmm. but then the processor and synergist roles really start to take center stage. And because of that, we start doing what we are doing ever more efficiently, mm-hmm. right? And it's that kind of constant pursuit of efficiency that actually starts to deplete our capacity for effectiveness. That's why organizations wow. start to decline. They decline yeah. inside long before they decline on their P&L, right? Mm-hmm. Long before any of the metrics say it, mm-hmm. they've already started to lose their capacity for future growth. And that's when they start to move into treadmill, and that's when they start to fall into the big rut. And when we get to the big rut, that's where you find heavily processor-centric organizations. And the challenging thing about the big rut is the processors are in charge and they think, finally, we've got this thing figured out, right? What have we done? We've eliminated all that messiness from visionaries, right? And some of the operators. And so you end up with this increasingly processor-driven organization. And we'll joke, you know, processors are like rabbits. You know, you stick them in a room together and 9 months later, you've got a dozen more processors. It's just, you know, like they flock together. And again, it's not a bad thing. It's just their wiring is mm-hmm. is driven toward efficiency. And so they do it ever increasingly better until it's not anymore. Mm. But it's gone so far for so long that they've lost their capacity for change. And that's why we see at the end of the life cycle stages, we've got this death rattle stage that happens. And really all that's left at that time are the processors who are there to make sure we go bankrupt precisely on time.
Oh, man. I felt that when he said that.
Yeah. And it's not to paint processors in a bad way.
No, not at
and,
all.
And so some visionaries and operators can hear that story and, you know, kind of pat their chests and go us, you know, we create these mm-hmm. wonderful growing startup organizations. Well, you look at the profit of a big rut organization versus the profit of your little startup, and mm-hmm. the processors aren't doing too bad for themselves, right? Like, and on either side of the equation, we lose either efficiency or effectiveness. And it's not mm-hmm. until we get all four styles together that we can truly achieve both. And that's why in predictable success, we can scale.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm fascinated with, Scott, is that you call yourself a capacity architect. And is that what you're describing through all of this, the last 30 minutes of our conversation? Is that what a capacity architect does?
Yeah. So my favorite part of the life cycle is a part of the life cycle that should not be a favorite part. Let's just put it that way. But it's whitewater. It's this time when these very successful organizations all of a sudden stop feeling successful. Mm-hmm. And the reason I like it so much is because I'm a visionary and a processor. That's my style combination. And the whole function of whitewater, of strategy for getting out of whitewater, is getting vision and process to work in tandem, mm-hmm. to get them to work in harmony and to hold the tension between those two styles. Mm-hmm. And I live with that tension between, you know, my two ears like every day of my life. And so it's like, finally I can, you know, join someone else in the madness. So I love working in that space. And what's happening there is that the organization is losing its capacity to execute, right? They're you know, you ask a CEO in that time, and you know, I've heard him say, it's like I have oven mitts on. I used to be able to feel the organization, right? I could tell when something was right or when something was wrong, but now everything's a little numb. Everything's a little distant. Or, you know, I've got this great group of team, and up until about 6 months ago, we could do anything we set our hand to. And now we just got dumped. Yeah, it's like the same group of people, but for some reason it's not working right. They've lost their capacity, right?
Oh, interesting.
And so what I love to do is come in and work with teams who are in whitewater to get that capacity, not back, because they actually never had that much capacity in the first place. They were riding a wave through fun. But to actually architect what happened intuitively back in fun. To really sit down and structure, here's actually what made us successful and here's how we can scale that up. And that's what I love to do. It's how I love to help organizations. And that's where that moniker came from.
That's awesome. as you kind of set the stage for, you know, who you are and the work that you do, you've shared about leadership, you've shared about the lifestyle of organizations and the need for systems. What does it mean to have an eight-figure focus?
Oh, it's a very good question. My favorite phrase when working with the team is to act your stage, right? We talk about acting your wage or whatever it may be. I think that's Dave Ramsey, but act your stage. And so having an eight-figure focus is about identifying where you are on that life cycle and then selecting the leaders and the strategies that are most effective at that stage. So you could be, an eight-figure focus for me is working up the left side of that arc, right? I tend to get a little bored once we get too far along because things are working too well. You know, I like it messy. That eight-figure focus, you could be brand new startup, have an eight-figure focus. You could be right at the cusp of breaking that $10 million barrier. And have an eight-figure focus. It doesn't necessarily matter where you are on that, but it matters that you recognize where you are and you act appropriately. So a lot of the organizations I work with and do coaching for, so founders, you know, sometimes I'll work with folks who are in the $1 to $5 million range, and that's typically one-on-one coaching. Mm-hmm. 90% of what I do in that space is tell people not to take advice that they've been given or tell them not to do something that they read in a book. Because that advice is coming from someone in predictable success or treadmill or, you know, dare I say, big rut. That book is written for someone who works in, you know, with multinational businesses that are dealing with the challenges of treadmill, right? Mm. And so we have to recognize the when of the advice that we're following. And so when we take these maxims like, hey, everyone should, you know, whatever it is, any book, you know, I'm not going to pick on any one in particular, but but you have to recognize who that audience is for. And if you're in that audience, right, the real audience, because they may not even recognize the when factor, right? Mm-hmm. They may be looking from their world. And it's like looking from, you know, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. It's like looking from Atlanta. I can't see any other state, right? And so if I talk about how to survive out in the wild here and someone picks up, you know, that material in the desert, it's right. not going to be that helpful for them, right? Yeah. But I don't know that because I can't see anything beyond the wonderful trees that are all changing colors here this time of year. And so it's not to put anyone in a bad picture or say that people are giving bad advice, but any advice, no matter how good it is, if it's implemented in the wrong timing, is bad advice. And so having an eight-figure focus, particularly for growing organizations, even more particularly for growing organizations that love to learn and love to develop, is to stop doing that, right? At least to the extent that you're learning and developing skills that are not appropriate for your stage.
So fascinating, because it seems like the key to this all is knowing the stage that you're in, acting appropriately. And that has to align with the whole notion of hustling too, because hustle changes depending upon what stage you're in, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of the work that I do is for organizations who have been in or are in, or sometimes want to get back to fun. Yeah. And fun is where you get the highest return on hustle. And it's a bit of a drug, actually, because you get into the early stages of fun, and when you hustle, it works. And so it's like, okay, you know, what works gets repeated, and it's like, hey, this thing's moving, and it just kind of, it carries its own momentum. But then what happens is you reach this kind of critical mass, and there's no fixed point that it happens. It's a blend that just kind of happens over time. But what accumulates is you go from fulfilling, right? That's what the hustle is in the early days, is getting stuff done, to firefighting. And that ratio starts to get out of whack. At first, it's, you know, maybe 90% fulfilling and 10% firefighting. Well, you get to a point where it's 10% fulfilling and 90% firefighting. That's not an effective organization.
Right.
Right. And that's what hustle does. Hustle, it's one of those two options, and left to its own devices, it will always, over time, as a virtue of its own success, degrade into firefighting if you're not careful.
Yeah. Ooh, good words. Wise words. Sounds like words learned from experience.
I have done my share of hustling. It took us years. I ran an organization. Through a series of unfortunate events, relaunched the organization and built it up after it had been unintentionally but systematically destroyed. So we rebuild this organization. We get out of early struggle. We get into fun. It's this glorious time. And we keep driving and keep driving, and it's up and to the right. You know, everything that we did was up and to the right. It was addition by addition, and let's just go. And what ended up happening after years of success was our top line kept growing, but our bottom line wasn't keeping up. Every year we would sell more, but we would keep a lower percentage of that. And when that goes on for 3-4 years, like, it gets your attention, you know, it's like, we're doing a lot more work. We got a lot more stress. And what do we have to show for it at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. And it was being in that place, for about 3 years that I heard about the predictable success model, found out we're in Whitewater, and it's this "you are here" moment. You know, you ever get lost at a mall? Right. You know, it's like no one goes to the mall anymore. I'm not gonna be able to use this illustration in 15 years, but it's that "you are here" thing. This, okay, I got it. And for most entrepreneurs, they have a similar experience that I did, and they walked off the map a long time ago. Right? That's all you could use that as the definition of entrepreneur, one who walks off the map. They do what they've been told can't be done, and they do it consistently and successfully over time. And what it does is it leads us to believe that there's no map at all, when in fact we had just been given a bad map to start. There actually is a map. It's, you know, it's the life cycle stages we talked about. We all go through that. And when you recognize, I'm not dumb, I'm actually in Whitewater. You know, when you recognize we're not being singled out by the universe, we're just entered into a stage that every successful organization goes into. It demystifies what is otherwise a highly mysterious process of falling into Whitewater. Mm. And when I heard about that, it was just a revelation, you know. In his book, my business partner Les, who I get the pleasure of working with now, it's like he's got a camera in your office, you know. it's creepy how accurate it is. And now I travel all over the country and teach this all over the place, and people call me afterwards and like, "Hey, have you been reading my emails?" You know, like, how do you, like, because it's so predictable. And so when you find out that you're on a map, mm. and you recognize we're not just screwing up, we're just going through a natural part of this process, it's so comforting. Because the next question is, the next revelation is, if we're on a map, then somebody knows the way out. Right. Ooh, yeah. And that's what we get to do. There's a handful of things, not that complex. There's just a handful of things, hard work, very mm-hmm. hard work. But if you do those things and you do them in the right order, then that will walk you through that Whitewater period and into predictable success. We did that as an organization. I, like most people, heard about it and then sat on it for another 3 years. I don't know why we do that, but we do. Mm-hmm. But finally had enough of Whitewater. And it's like, okay, we're moving on. Like, we're figuring this out. We followed the protocol, walked through it step by step. And in a year's time, we had added $1 million to the bottom line of the organization. Wow. And from then on, I was like, yeah, this is the thing. This is a real deal.
So your episode is unique in that it's launching on December 31st. So right at the cusp between years. And so as people listening to this episode hear the words that you're saying, maybe they are living their business life as if there is no map, or their eyes are open to what you just said about there being a map. What advice would you have for people as they look forward to 2022?
That's excellent. Do not make a plan for a coming year without recognizing what stage you're in. It really is that. And I have a dog in this fight. Yes. Like I have, you know, I have what I think is a very, very good tool to use. I don't care what tool you use, find another one, use anyone. But whatever it is, you have to ask and answer the when question first. Because if you go and chase a bunch of strategies that are not appropriate for your stage, you're going to spend a lot of money, you're going to spend a lot of time, you're going to spend a lot of energy, and you're just going to spin your wheels. And so anyone who's looking forward to the next year, there's tons of advice that I could go any direction, but what I would recommend is look at what stage you're in, right? Identify the stage and then follow the plan for that stage. Now, the question is, okay, how do I do that, right? How do I know what stage I'm in? A couple of free resources that we have on our site that'll be helpful is we've got a book on the topic. It's called Predictable Success, How to Get Your Organization on the Growth Track and Keep It There. But you don't have to buy the book. We've got the first chapter that explains all seven stages. Nice. And we've done a ton of work of making this as simple and as accessible as possible. So we're not using crazy business terms that, you know, you have to have a doctorate degree to understand. Right. It's real simple stuff, just what I talked about now. And that's assuming that you don't already feel it. You know, most of the time I just do a cursory run through the different stages and people will feel the stage that they're in. But you can go check that out. You can also, there's a free quiz that you can take on the site. It's right there on the homepage, scalearchitects.com, that will let you take the lifecycle quiz. So you can just fill in a handful of questions and it'll spit out a report that tells you what stage you're in and give you some ideas on how to approach it.
That's excellent. As you were describing the resources too, I had a thought, and it is, how does this lifestyle of an organization apply to maybe like artists or writers or non-traditional forms of organization?
That's a great, great question. We have a course on exactly that thing. I think it's $97. It's not expensive, but it talks about that. The biggest thing for folks in that space to recognize is that regardless of what you do or how you do it, or the 19,000 ways that you are unique and
right,
you are, you're a snowflake. I'm with you. But all snowflakes fall with gravity at the same rate. You know, it's just, you know, there are certain things that are consistent about all of our experiences. And a big part of for folks in that space is that you have to recognize that the visionary operator combination is at play for you. Mm-hmm. And so what that means, if you're there by yourself, you have to fill both of those roles. And that leaves you with a question. You know, if what you enjoy is to just kind of enter into that VO space, you do some selling, you fulfill it, and you know, you're happy, then just be happy with it, right? It's just, you don't have to change, you don't have to make it different. But if you have any plans of going beyond yourself, right? If you have any plans of creating an organization, which some people do, some people don't, but if you do, you've got to deal with the visionary operator combination very, very quickly. Because otherwise, what ends up happening, if you try and fill both of those roles, you try and do everything for the long run, what will happen is you'll fall into something that we call the artisan trap. Mm. And it's precisely the experience that, you know, probably just about every other guest on your show can attest to having experienced. Maybe they're still in it, maybe they've overcome it. But the artisan trap is where we just get stuck. And for many of us, it's in a substandard form of living, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. But where we're kind of oscillating back and forth between this visionary and operator thing, if we're really a strong creative visionary, then it's because we don't want to do the hard work of being an operator, right? We don't want to make the sales call for the 15th time or whatever it may be. And so if you don't work those two styles, you're not going to get the traction you need to get out of early struggle. And so folks that are stuck in that solo space, they have to take a look at that and just say, first off, what do I want this to be? Mm-hmm. Do I want it to be a business? Do I want it to be something that I love, right? Like, mm-hmm. Do I want it to be both? Anything there. I don't think one's better than the other. It's not like being an organization is better than being a solopreneur. I don't care what you choose. But based on what you choose, you have to recognize how that reality is showing up, right? How are you showing up mm-hmm. with the visionary and operator style? Because it's primarily what you need.
Yeah. Ooh, thank you for that. That was excellent. Well, final question for you, Scott. I'm a huge reader, and I assume based upon the depth of wisdom that you have, you're a reader as well. But what book, podcast, or resource is currently blowing your mind right now?
Oh, that's hard, because it's like a constant flow. So this goes against what I said earlier. My favorite kind of more recent book has been The Infinite Game by, Simon Sinek. I will offer it with a caveat, though, that it is a visionary synergist book. And so if you are struggling with your team for a lack of vision or a lack of synergy, it's a brilliant, brilliant resource. And he does an exceptional job at in our language, showing organizations how to get out of treadmill that have gotten stuck there. And just has a brilliant depiction and lovely stories about what it's like to be in predictable success. For many of the folks who tend to be my clients over on the growth side, you have to be careful because Simon Sinek does not like operators. But we don't want to overdo the visionary synergist definition of leadership. But it's a great, great book about that stage of predictable success that we talked about. So that would be that'd be one of the more recent ones.
Excellent. Well, Scott, thank you so much for just sharing your wisdom on getting work to work. I have learned so much, and I can't wait to continue exploring these concepts. And I can't wait for people to hear this conversation because there's so much to learn in it. Thank you.
Absolutely. And yeah, like I said, it's December 31st. So 22 is upon us. And for anyone who has been, sparked something in them, I'd highly encourage you to go ahead and head over to the Scale Architects website. We have so many free resources there that will help you as you're planning for next year to get the absolute most out of the year ahead.
I can't think of a better conversation to have had to end the year with and to kick off 2022. Whether you need to understand your own leadership styles or want to understand which stage in the life cycle of an organization your business is in, you most likely heard some things in this episode that illuminate the work that you need to do this year. So be sure to check out Scott's links at gwtw.co/579 and to learn about the resources that he shared in this episode. I hope you have a great new year, and there's going to be more excellent episodes of Getting Work to Work in the new year, more monologues, more conversations. Thank you for being here. It's always a joy on my end to learn and share with you. Thank you. Until next year, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.